John Henry checked his pocket watch. 11 o'clock. The wagon's bringing down the first load of bullion from the mountains ought to be here soon. He'd really expected them to show up earlier than this.
I know. I thought they'd be here by now, too.
Mayor Cravens took out a handkerchief and mopped sweat from his forehead, even though the day was cool.
Maybe Gilmore decided one load was enough and he hit them in the mountains.
I don't think so. He wouldn't be satisfied with a third of what he could get if he waited until all the gold is here.
The bank was closed for business today, and the front door was locked. The head teller, Harley Smoot, had come into work, though, and stood at the windows looking out at the street.
They're here, Mr. Cravens!
Thank God. It's about time.
Cravens hurried toward the door to unlock it. John Henry was right behind the banker. He stepped out onto the boardwalk to watch the impressive procession coming down the street. Two wagons, drawn by teams of six strong mules, rolled toward the bank, each driven by a hard-faced man who wore two revolvers. Beside each driver rode an equally grim guard, also armed with a pair of six guns and a double-barreled greener. Two Winchesters lay on the floorboard. That was a lot of firepower. It was just the start, though. Four men, each of them heavily armed as well, rode in front of the lead wagon. Four more guards were positioned between the wagons, and a final four brought up the rear. 12 guards on horseback, four more on the wagons themselves, counting the drivers. If they were attacked, they could put up a fight, that was for sure. In front of both wagons and all the guards came a buggy with two more men in it. One was another shotgun-wielding guard. The man holding the reins was Jason True. He handled the team of two black horses pulling the buggy briskly and efficiently. So the first load of bullion came from True's San Francisco mine. John Henry looked along the street and saw that the boardwalks were unusually empty. Once he thought about it for a second, he understood why. Rumors must have been flying about the gold being brought to town today. With that many guards working for the mine owners, it would have been impossible to keep the schedule a total secret. The townspeople had to figure that Billy Ray Gilmore probably had his eye on the bullion. The citizens of Purgatory were going to keep their heads down, well out of the line of fire, until that gleaming fortune was gone from their town. That was good for his purposes. When hell broke loose, there would be less chance of an innocent bystander getting hurt. And hell was going to break loose. John Henry had no doubt of that. Jason True brought his buggy to a halt in front of the bank. Gold-laden wagons pulled up behind him. John Henry could see now that canvas was stretched over the bed of each wagon, but there were enough gaps around it that stacks of wooden crates were visible. Each crate would have several ingots of bullion inside it, he knew.
Thank God you're here safely. Did you have any trouble?
Not a bit.
True looped the reins around the buggy's brake lever. With the agility of a younger man, he jumped down from the vehicle.
Yep. We just got a bit later start than we intended. Six Killer, how does everything look?
Good. I don't think you're going to have any problems.
I'll believe that when I see it.
True turned and gestured to his men.
Let's get it unloaded and inside the bank.
The guards dismounted. Half of them arranged themselves around the wagons, holding rifles slanted across their chests and facing outwards so their eyes could constantly scan the buildings along the street, alert for any signs of trouble. The other guards began hauling the crates into the bank.
How many men are you leaving with me?
There will be four guards around the bank.
Four? Is that all? Gilmore has at least a dozen men.
That's all we can spare. Not as many men showed up as we were expecting. I suppose they decided double wages weren't enough for risking their lives. But you have your own special guard as well.
Well, it's not enough.
We do the best we can. There are a lot more places up in the mountains where Gilmore and his gang could ambush the wagons. We need the guards there. I'll be staying here too, Joe. We'll be all right.
I don't know why Wells Fargo couldn't just meet you here today and take charge of the gold right away.
They have limited manpower as well. And besides, they couldn't leave with it until tomorrow morning anyway.
I suppose. I won't rest, though, until it's out of my safe and on its way to Lordsburg.
The air of tension inside the bank and elsewhere in town grew even stronger as the day went on. By the time the second load of bullion arrived shortly after 1 o'clock in the afternoon, this one from Arnold Goodman's El Halcon mine, Purgatory looked like a ghost town.
Did you encounter any trouble?
Jason True spoke to Goodman as they watched the guards unloading the gold. The stocky, bulldog-like mine owner shook his head.
No sign of Gilmore or any other desperado.
Goodman looked at John Henry.
This is the gunslinger Craven's hired?
That's right. John Henry, sixth killer, this is Arnold Goodman.
Goodman didn't offer to shake hands. He looked at John Henry with narrow, suspicious eyes.
I don't like the idea of trusting a man who makes his living with a gun.
Some people feel the same way about men who make their living sitting in boardrooms.
I didn't always sit in a boardroom. If you want, I'll prove it.
Settle down, Arnold. Let's worry about Gilmore, not about fighting with someone who's here to help us.
How do we know he's here to help us?
If he's not, then God help him, because he'll regret it.
John Henry kept his face impassive and didn't say anything. They would all know the truth about him soon enough. Once Goodman's gold was unloaded and stowed away in the safe, the wagons and their accompanying guards would head up into the mountains once more, bound for Dan Lacey's Bonita mine, where they would pick up the final load of bullion. Four guards posted around the bank wouldn't be enough to fight off Gilmore's gang, John Henry thought. Cravens had been right about that. He checked the street again, then went over to True and Goodman.
I think you ought to leave more men here this time. Since there's more gold here now than the wagons will be bringing down, the odds have tipped the other way. This is where the greatest danger is.
Of course, he knew from talking to Gilmore when the outlaws planned to strike, but he wasn't ready to reveal that. For one thing, he was convinced that Gilmore had another inside man, and John Henry didn't know that man's identity. He didn't want anybody tipping off Gilmore that the plan was compromised. Also, there was always the chance that Gilmore had lied to him and planned to rob the bank before the third load got there. In that case, having some extra guards on hand might save the day.
I'm not sure we should be taking advice from
Hold on. Sixth Killer may be onto something there. If Gilmore was to hit the bank after the wagons start back up to Lacey's mine, he could get twice as much bullion here than he could if he made a try for the wagons.
He wants it all.
You're probably right. But it won't hurt to leave a few more guards here. In fact, let's split them and keep 8 men here while 8 men go with the wagons.
Goodman didn't look happy about it, but he reluctantly went along with the idea.
This it better not backfire, though. If it does, I'm blaming you and Sixth Killer.
John Henry didn't give a damn about blame. He just wanted to get this over with. Something else was nagging at him. He hadn't seen Sophie Clearwater or Doc Mitchum since the night before last. He didn't know if they were even still in purgatory, or if they'd given up the idea of stealing the gold and left town. With all the plans he had made, those two were still wild cards, and they could ruin everything if they interfered at the wrong time. It was too late to do anything about them. In a few hours, the third load of bullion would be here, and Billy Ray Gilmore would make his move. That is, if he didn't strike before then. With approximately half as many guards as they'd had before, the empty wagons left Purgatory and started back up the winding trail into the mountains where the mines were located. The bank's front door was locked, and two of the extra guards were stationed at the door of the room containing the safe. The rear door was not only locked, but had a heavy bar across it. No one would be getting in that way without a considerable amount of trouble or a fistful of dynamite. Couldn't rule anything out, but if Gilmore had been telling the truth, he intended to come in the front after slaughtering the guards. He had paid attention to the time it was when the wagons left after delivering the load from the San Francisco and when they got back with the bullion from El Halcón.
Is Lacey's mine closer to the settlement or farther from it than yours?
It's the farthest of the three, a couple of miles farther from town than mine. Why?
Just trying to figure out how long it's going to take for the wagons to get back.
True took out his pocket watch and flipped it open.
They ought to be back here by 5 o'clock.
The shank of the afternoon.
Why is that important?
I'm just curious.
John Henry was going to wait as long as he could before springing the truth on them, even though he had decided that the guard who was in Gilmore's pay probably wasn't here in the bank. Gilmore's plan called for him to eliminate all the guards inside the building, which would have put the spy at risk. More than likely, the man was outside, where he could abandon his post and scurry for cover as soon as the shooting started. Time dragged by. Cravens mopped his sweating face.
What if they don't show up? What if Gilmore decided it's too risky and he isn't even going to make a try for the gold?
Then we'll count our blessings. I can't bring myself to believe that's the case, though.
Neither can I. They'll be here. It's just a matter of when.
John Henry knew the when, or at least thought he did. He kept checking his watch, and so did the other men. At 4:45, he approached True, Goodman, and Cravens, who were standing together near the front windows, watching the street for the arrival of the wagons.
There's something I need to tell you.
I knew it. You're double-crossing us.
Not exactly.
John Henry slipped a hand inside his coat. The three men tensed, no doubt thinking he was about to draw some sort of weapon. Instead, he brought out a leather folder and flipped it open. On one side was pinned his badge, and the other held the card identifying him as a Deputy United States Marshal.
A lawman? Good Lord! All this time you've been a lawman?
That doesn't mean anything. Anybody can have a badge and a piece of paper.
But only somebody who really is who he says he is would know about that letter you wrote to Judge Parker in Fort Smith, Mr. True.
Letter? What letter?
You work for Isaac?
Yes, sir, I do.
True looked at the other mine owner and the banker.
I was worried that our preparations wouldn't be enough, so I wrote an old friend of mine who's a federal judge and asked if he could send someone to help us. Of course, I expected more than one man, and I didn't expect the man who showed up to masquerade as a gunslinger.
I reckon I'm the only one the judge could spare right now. And as far as acting like a gunslinger, that allowed me to partner up with Gilmore.
You...
Hold on. You'll bust a vein, Mr. Goodman. I should have said that allowed me to pretend to partner up with Gilmore. He thinks I'm going to double-cross you fellas and kill the guards in here when he and his gang attack the rest of the guards outside, as soon as the wagons get here with the last of the bullion.
He told you this? He let you in on his plans?
That's right. And having him reveal that was my plan.
They're attacking as soon as the wagons get here with the third load? We've got to do something. That could be any minute now.
I know. That's why I want you to let me out the back door, then lock it and bar it behind me.
You're running out on us.
Nope. I just need to get outside where I can move around easier. Plus, I've put together a little welcome for Gilmore.
I don't know about any of this.
Do what Six Killer says, Joe. If he works for Isaac Parker, I have complete faith in him.
He's been fooling us all along. How do we know we can trust him now?
What other choice do we have?
All right, Mr. Six Killer. I'll let you out the back. I guess you weren't ever really working for me, were you?
I'm afraid not, Mayor. But we're after the same thing. Protecting that gold and putting a stop to the threat of Billy Ray Gilmore and his gang.
Cravens led John Henry to the back door. John Henry removed the bar and Cravens unlocked the door. John Henry slipped out into the alley behind the bank. The ladder was right where he had left it that morning. He climbed to the roof. A short wall surrounded the flat roof. The things John Henry had placed beside that wall at the front of the building were still there too. Staying low again because he didn't want to be spotted, he hurried over to them and knelt there to unwrap them from the burial shroud. The bow he pulled out of the cloth was a crude one, nothing like the bows his father's people made back in Indian Territory. Si Schuster had fashioned it in his carpentry shop, turning a length of supple wood on a lathe to round it, then stringing it with cord instead of animal gut. The half-dozen arrows John Henry unwrapped were actually just short lengths of wood poles notched to fit the cord. They didn't have any fletching, so accuracy might be a problem. But luckily, they wouldn't have to go very far. John Henry reached into the canvas sack that held his purchases from the general store. He used twine he had bought to lash a single stick of dynamite to each of the makeshift arrows. To each stick of dynamite, he attached a blasting cap and a short fuse. He set them down, lining them up in a row within easy reach. Now it was just a matter of waiting for the right time to use them. He didn't have to wait very long. He took off his hat, lifted his head enough to look along the street. The wagons were on their way. He could see them entering the edge of town, along with the guards riding around them. John Henry watched as the wagons came closer and closer. One of the men riding in front of the lead wagon wore an expensive suit and hat, and a watch chain glittered where it looped across his vest. John Henry knew he had to be Dan Lacey, owner of the Bonita Mine. The third load of bullion was here. Below John Henry, the front door of the bank opened. Wagons came to a halt, the riders reined in. Jason True stepped out onto the boardwalk.
Lacey! Lacey, get inside the building! Hurry!
Jason, what's wrong?
Suddenly, a large group of horsemen surged around a corner two blocks away. John Henry saw Billy Ray Gilmore in the lead. He was shocked to realize that the gang was even larger than he'd expected. At least 2 dozen men were with Gilmore, maybe more than that. John Henry took the cigar he had gotten from Bouchard out of his pocket, put it in his mouth, and lit it. He picked up the closest dynamite arrow. He held the fuse to the coal. Then he stood up and drew back the bow.
Banks closed!
The arrow didn't travel quite as far as John Henry hoped it would, landing well in front of the onrushing outlaws. By that time, John Henry had adjusted his aim and had 2 more of the arrows arcing through the air. He didn't slow down his barrage. As the gang scattered, he raised the angle of his shots even more, rained down death and destruction through the swirling clouds of dust. He turned and ran to the back of the bank building. As quick as he could, he climbed down the ladder. He landed running and darted around the corner to head for the street. The outlaws were demoralized and disoriented by John Henry's explosive counterattack. But the ones who were still alive weren't giving up, not with the lure of $75,000 in gold bullion to keep them fighting. John Henry had drawn his Colt as he ran along the alley. He crouched as a slug whined over his head. He shifted his aim. He saw the giant outlaw Rankin leaving his horse in a diving tackle. John Henry brought up his Colt and smashed it against Rankin's head just above the big man's ear. That drove Rankin to the side and allowed John Henry to roll in the other direction. While John Henry was doing that, Rankin scrambled back to his feet first. John Henry tried to swing up the revolver, but Rankin's foot lashed out in a kick that connected with John Henry's wrist. Rankin pulled a massive bowie knife from a sheath at his hip.
I'm gonna cut you into little pieces, you son of a...
Rankin's face blew apart as a heavy slug crashed through his head from behind. John Henry's first thought was that one of the guards at the bank had shot Rankin, but suddenly he realized that the angle was wrong for that. The shot had come from somewhere else, most likely across the street. He looked toward the Barrymore house and saw a curtain flutter in one of the hotel's second-floor windows. Whoever was up there had quite possibly saved his life. John Henry lifted his left hand in a wave of thanks as he reached down with his right to scoop up his Colt. He didn't linger. There were still outlaws to battle, and he didn't know if Billy Ray Gilmore was dead or alive. John Henry whirled to see one of the gang charging him.
Dick Skiller, you son of a bitch! You double-crossed me!
John Henry recognized Billy Ray Gilmore's voice and searched for the boss outlaw in the roiling clouds of dust and powder smoke. He triggered a couple of shots. Twisting aside, as another slug sizzled past his ear, he darted into the scanty cover of the building's corner and reached for the cartridge loops on his gun belt. As he reloaded with the ease of long practice, he risked a glance around the corner, not needing to see what he was doing as he thumbed fresh rounds into the Colt cylinder. He spotted Gilmore right away. The outlaw had been unhorsed in the chaos and confusion. He'd lost his hat, too, and his thick, dark hair was wildly askew. He ran toward a riderless horse, obviously intending to swing up into the saddle and make a getaway. John Henry burst from cover and went after Gilmore. Gilmore got the animal under control and grabbed the saddle horn. A vault put him into the saddle, where he leaned far forward over the horse's neck as he kicked the animal into a gallop. Gilmore headed for the edge of town, leaving his surviving men behind him. Obviously, his hide was worth more to him than the rapidly fading chances of him getting his hands on any of that bullion. Gilmore was already too far away for John Henry to waste a shot with his Colt. He ought to just let the outlaw go. After all, Judge Parker had sent him here to protect the gold. Clearly, Gilmore's plans to steal it were wrecked. John Henry knew that, but he grabbed the reins of another riderless horse anyway, leaped into the saddle. Leaving things unfinished went against the grain for him. Purgatory fell behind the two men. Gilmore headed west out of town toward the mountains. He was following the same road the wagons had used to bring the gold down from the mines. The road quickly began to slant upward, and John Henry felt the horse laboring underneath him. Gilmore's mount was struggling too, though. As his horse slowed, he twisted in the saddle to look behind him. John Henry holstered his Colt. The hurricane deck of a galloping horse was no place for accurate shooting. Let Gilmore waste bullets if he wanted to. John Henry didn't know if his mount was fresher or just stronger to start with, or both, but he began to cut into Gilmore's lead. He saw Gilmore jam the iron back into its holster, then lean forward to concentrate on his riding. The road took a bend up ahead. Gilmore had to slow down for that. John Henry closed in even more. He could see the sweat on Gilmore's face now when the outlaw looked back over his shoulder. John Henry urged the last bit of speed out of his horse. He drew even with Gilmore to the outlaw's right. Gilmore had drawn a knife from somewhere and slashed at John Henry with it. John Henry ducked the blade, kicked his feet free of the stirrups, and left the saddle in a diving tackle that sent him crashing into Gilmore. Gilmore had managed to hang on to the knife. John Henry saw steel glitter as the blade came flashing toward his face. He got his left hand up and grabbed Gilmore's wrist, stopping the thrust when the knife was scant inches from his throat. He brought up his right fist in a straight punch that landed solidly on Gilmore's jaw and twisted him to the side. John Henry rolled after him, holding on for dear life to the wrist of Gilmore's knife hand. With his free hand, he hammered punches into Gilmore's head and body. Gilmore was fighting with the strength and rage of the insane, though, and he threw John Henry off. A quick roll put him on top of the lawman. He drove the knife down with all his power. John Henry was barely able to hold it off.
You double-crossed me! Were you working for the mine owners all along?
I work for Uncle Sam. I'm a deputy U.S. Marshal.
That took Gilmore by surprise. John Henry could tell by the way the outlaw's eyes widened. But the revelation didn't shock Gilmore into slipping. In a desperate move, John Henry brought his right leg up and hooked it in front of Gilmore's throat. He arched up off the ground as he straightened a leg and drove Gilmore backwards. John Henry scrambled to his feet. Gilmore did likewise. Gilmore still had the knife. He swung it wildly. John Henry ducked under the sweeping blow, stepped closer, and brought his right fist almost from the ground in an uppercut that caught Gilmore under the chin. When he came down, there was no ground under his feet anymore. John Henry had knocked him right off the edge of the road. John Henry looked down at the sprawled form, saw the grotesquely sharp angle at which Gilmore's head now rested on his neck, and knew that the outlaw hadn't survived the fall. The horses hadn't gone very far. When he had caught his breath, John Henry mounted one of them and led the other as he started back down toward Purgatory. He could see the town below him. The late afternoon air was quiet now. The battle against Gilmore's gang was over. He thought suddenly about all that gold bullion and about Sophie Clearwater and Doc Mitchum as well. By the time John Henry reached Purgatory, Marshal Henry Hinkle and Sheriff Elmer Stone were making themselves visible, striding around Main Street issuing orders about the disposal of all the dead bodies living about. John Henry didn't recall seeing either of the lawmen during the battle, but they were certainly in evidence now. He ignored them and proceeded straight to the bank.
Marshal Six Killer, no one knew where you were. I was afraid you'd been killed.
I went after Gilmore. Probably shouldn't have. Is the gold all right?
All stowed away in the bank's safe. What about Gilmore? Did he get away? Do we have to worry about him coming back?
No. In fact, Cy Schuster's going to have some work waiting for him out of town once he's through here. That is, if the scavengers haven't dragged off Gilmore's carcass by then.
I hate to celebrate the death of any man, but in Billy Ray Gilmore's case, I'll make an exception.
John Henry thought that was allowable, especially when True went on to tell him that three of the guards had been killed in the fighting. That paled next to the number of casualties among the outlaws, though. 18 of them were dead, and the five prisoners were all wounded, three of them seriously. Those dynamite arrows of John Henry's had wreaked some serious havoc among the desperados. With more than a dozen guards left to take care of the gold, John Henry figured it was safe to leave the bank. When he reached his room, he found the door open. Della was still sitting up in his bed, and Royal Bouchard was in the chair beside her, holding her hand.
John Henry, thank God you're alive. Royal saw you from the window when you rode back into town and said that you looked like you were all right. You are all right, aren't you?
I'm fine. And you don't have to worry about Gilmore. He and most of his gang are dead.
Good riddance. I can take Della back to the Silver Spur now.
Actually, I've been thinking. It would probably be better if she wasn't moved just yet. So why don't the two of you just stay here for a few days? Meade can take care of the saloon, can't he?
He sure can, and I can take care of Della.
Is that what you really want, Royal?
It surely is.
But what about you, John Henry? Where will you stay?
Well, I figured I'd spend the night at the bank. There's still a fortune in gold bullion over there, and my job is to protect it until Wells Fargo takes over in the morning.
You don't think anybody else is gonna make a try for it, do you? Nobody else in these parts has a big enough gang but Gilmore.
Sometimes it doesn't take a gang.
Three of the guards were in the bank, along with John Henry, that night. Fortified with good meals and several pots of coffee, they were ready to stay there till morning, when the Wells Fargo wagons would arrive. John Henry didn't really expect any trouble, but as long as the gold was here, it was a target. He glanced at the clock to see it was about 10. Only a small lamp was burning on one of the desks. He motioned for the guards to stay where they were and drew his Colt as he approached the door. The curtains were drawn over the glass in the door so nobody could look in. He flicked one of the curtains aside and looked out. Jason True, Arnold Goodman, and Dan Lacey stood on the boardwalk, along with Marshall Hinkle and tall, spare, middle-aged Harley Smoot, the bank's head teller. John Henry had no idea why the mine owners would be here unless they wanted to check on the gold. That was feasible, he supposed, but why were Hinkle and Smoot with them?
What's wrong?
We need to check the safe. There's been some sort of trick. Something's been substituted for the bullion.
That's loco. It's just not possible. The gold's been locked up in the safe all day.
We just want to look to be sure, Marshal. We brought along Mr. Smoot to open the safe. Once we've seen for ourselves that everything is all right, we won't bother you again.
Well, all right.
The gold belonged to them, after all. John Henry didn't see any way he could refuse to let them look at their own gold. He stepped back. Lacey lowered his shoulder and drove forward, slamming the door open so that it struck John Henry and knocked him backwards. John Henry caught his balance, but before he could raise his gun, he found himself looking down the twin barrels of the sawed-off shotgun that Lacey clutched in both hands. Hinkle had charged into the bank right behind Lacey. He leveled the shotgun he held at the guards.
Don't move!
Wisely, the guards obeyed. At this range, the sawed-off in Hinkle's hands could sweep all of them off their feet in a deadly lead hailstorm. True and Goodman stepped into the bank, prodded from behind by Harley Smoot, who also carried one of the shortened shotguns. John Henry knew as soon as he saw that Gilmore's other inside man had been Smoot, not one of the guards.
Sorry, Marshal. They forced Arnold and me to cooperate.
Drop your gun, Six Killer.
What if I don't?
Then I'll blow your head off and we'll kill those guards and True and Goodman as well. I'll say that we caught you and the guards trying to steal the gold yourselves, and Jason and Arnold were killed in the crossfire before the Marshal and I cut you down. Who's going to doubt me? On the other hand, if you do what you're told, all we do is take the gold and nobody has to die.
You'd steal your own gold?
What gold? Those boxes of mine are filled with lead ingots, not gold. My mind played out months ago. I've just been biding my time, waiting to make a big haul from the other two mines. Gilmore was supposed to help me do that, but you ruined that plan. Luckily, I had something else in mind in case Gilmore failed.
Yeah, me. I might not be too happy about you playing both sides, Lacey, if I wasn't going to come out of this a rich man.
And in the end, that's all that matters, isn't it? So what's it going to be, Six Killer? Are you going to be reasonable?
Slowly, John Henry reached over and laid his Colt on a nearby desk.
Good. Back away from it. Go over there with the guards. All of you drop your guns and be quick about it.
Facing the terrible threat of the sawed-offs, the men had no choice but to comply. They set their rifles aside and unbuckled their gun belts. At this range, the bank would look like a charnel house if those scatterguns started bellowing.
Now we're going to put you to work. There are three wagons parked in the alley out back. You'll load the boxes from the San Francisco and the El Halcón into them. Just leave the ones from Bonita. They're not worth a damn anyway.
You paid off your miners to go along with the sham?
As long as they got their wages, they didn't care. Now move. With six of you working, it won't take long to get the wagons loaded.
And when that chore was finished, Lacey, Hinkle, and Smoot would kill all of them, John Henry thought. They wouldn't want to leave witnesses behind to testify about who was really responsible for the robbery. Although when the three men dropped out of sight, anybody with half a brain could figure it out. In a court of law, though, there wouldn't be any evidence to convict them. Knowing that to finish the chore would be to sign his death warrant, John Henry didn't get in a hurry to load the bullion on the wagons parked behind the bank once Smoot had opened the safe. The other guards seemed to have figured out the same thing he had, because they were dragging their feet, too.
Hurry up, dammit. I want to be a long way from here by morning.
You won't get away with this.
Of course I will.
No, you won't. I'll hunt you down.
We'll see.
Drop those guns!
Lacey whirled toward the sound. At the same time, Smoot took a step out from the doorway. Smoot was closer, so John Henry decked him. John Henry left his feet in a diving tackle that caught Lacey around the knees from behind and upended him. Lacey let go of the now empty shotgun and slashed a punch across John Henry's face. He heaved his body upward and threw the federal lawman to the side. Inkle rushed out into the alley through the bank's rear door and swung his shotgun toward John Henry. With John Henry and Lacey so close together, the blast would probably kill the mine owner as well, but Hinkle was obviously panic-stricken and ready to pull the triggers. John Henry took advantage of the distraction. Doc Mitchum held the lantern high, and the glow it spread over the alley revealed not only the revolver in his other hand, but also the pistol held firmly in the grasp of Sophie Clearwater as she stepped forward.
Don't try to get up, Mr. Lacey. I'd hate to have to kill you, because I want to see you behind bars, but I will if I have to.
Realization burst on John Henry like an artillery shell.
Your law?
Not the same sort as you, Marshal. Doc and I work for Wells Fargo. We were sent ahead to make sure the gold stays safe until our wagons get here for it. But when we found out a deputy U.S. Marshal was on the job, too, we figured we'd let you do most of the work for us.
You knew I was a lawman?
Not all the time. We just got word yesterday. You may not be well-known in New Mexico territory, Marshal, but you sure are back in Indian territory, and Wells Fargo has contacts all over the country.
John Henry looked over at Mitchum.
Was that you who made the shot from the hotel that killed Rankin?
That big bruiser about to wade into you with a Bowie? No, that was Sophie. She's a crack shot with a rifle, too.
Well, you're just full of surprises, aren't you, Miss Clearwater?
Life's more interesting that way. Wouldn't you say, Marshal Six Killer?
The armored, heavily guarded Wells Fargo wagons rolled out of Purgatory the next day, bound for Lordsburg with $50,000 worth of bullion from the mines belonging to Jason True and Arnold Goldman. John Henry was glad to see them go. His job here was over, so he stopped by the hotel to say so long to Della and Bouchard before he pulled out.
The two of you take care of each other.
I think that's just what we'll be doing from here on out.
Royal insists I'm gonna retire. I'm willing to go along with that as long as he'll still let me hang around the saloon and look pretty.
No one's more qualified for that job than you are, my dear.
I'm pretty good when it comes to dealing cards, too, so I might work at that. I don't want life to get too settled and boring.
Not much chance of that in a town called Purgatory.
He said his farewells and went downstairs, and when he reached the hotel lobby, he was surprised to see Sophie Clearwater sitting in one of the chairs. She stood up and came toward him.
I thought you and Doc left with the gold wagons.
Well, Doc did. I told him I'd meet him in El Paso. I was hoping you and I could travel that far together.
That's a nice idea, but I'm not taking the stagecoach back to Lordsburg. I've got my horse with me.
I can get a horse. I'm a very good rider, you know.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me. I don't think it would do your reputation much good to spend a couple of nights on the trail with a man you're not married to, though.
I'm a lady detective. I don't have much of a reputation to start with, Marshal. Or should I call you John Henry?
Well, if we're going to be traveling together, I reckon you'd better call me John Henry.
Six Killer, U.S. Marshal, Day of Rage is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2012, William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with the Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Unauthorized download or duplication is prohibited. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Evan Casey, Kimberly Gilbert, Eric Messner, Alyssa Wilmoth, Michael John Casey, James Lewis, Christopher Graybill, Thomas Keegan, Dylan Lynch, David Coy, Carrie Tells, Tony Nam, James Konacek, Scott McCormick, Joe Brack, Nathaniel Perry, Drew Kopas, Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, and Ken Jackson. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. Directed by Nathaniel Perry. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. With original music by Thomas Hogan and Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Six Killer, U.S. Marshal, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's Luke Jensen Bounty Hunter series and Elmer Kelton's Texas Rangers series. Available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads, audio guides, and podcasts. Keep listening for exciting previews of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Matt Jensen 8, The Eyes of Texas.
By God, Moore! If you don't get up and go to another table, I'll kill you right where you're sitting.
I ain't going nowhere.
I'm going to count to three, and if you ain't out of that chair by the time I get to three, I'm going to blow your head off. One.
This ain't going to turn out good for you.
Two.
Son of a bitch. We've had three people killed in town today. That's a lot, even for Shady Rest.
The community of Shady Rest, Texas, has earned the unenviable reputation of being the deadliest town in Texas, if not in the entire United States of America. The name Shady Rest suggests a peaceful cemetery, and indeed, the population of the cemetery is growing nearly as fast as the population of the town, which seems bent upon reducing its number through almost daily murders.
What the hell, Dusty? Looky there! Stop the coach!
Whoa!
Damn!
What do you want?
What do you think I want? I want you to throw your money box down.
Are you crazy, mister? This here is the Van Horn and Shady Rest stage. We don't hardly ever carry no money.
All right, we'll just take whatever money your passengers have on them.
You men, throw down your guns.
What the hell?
Mister, I don't know who you are, but am I glad to see you. You just saved our bacon.
What's your name, mister?
It's Jensen. Matt Jensen. Where are you headed?
To Shady Rest. Tell the truth, mister. With Jim shot up like he is, I'd appreciate it if you would ride along with us.
I'm not gonna leave you.
Something has to be done, Mayor Trout. It has reached the point where decent people are afraid to be out on the street at any time now, not just after dark.
I agree. Something has to be done, but what?
Mayor Trout, I want you to appoint me to the position of City Marshal.
What?
This place is closed, as of now.
What?
Get all of your women down here now.
The hell I will? Are you crazy?
Get the women down here, now!
What is this? What's going on here?
All of the men, out now!
I ain't going nowhere till I get finished!
If you don't go now, you won't have anything to get finished with.
I tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna go back in there and shoot that crazy woman.
I don't think so.
What? Who the hell are you?
My name is Jensen. Deputy Matt Jensen. And I'm here to help the marshal if she needs any help.
If she needs any help? Wait a minute. Are you telling me that that crazy woman in there is a marshal?
That's exactly what I'm telling you.
What are you two boys doing here? Where's Mutt?
He's dead.
Dead?
Yeah. He was shot by a man named Matt Jensen.
And where is Jensen now?
He's back in Shady Rest.
All right. We're going to Shady Rest.
Why the hell do we want to go out there? We just left there.
Because we're going to kill Matt Jensen.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Matt Jensen 8, The Eyes of Texas.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
Justin Nash, number 2, Powder River.
Me? My name's Justin Nash. These days I was going by the name of James Beatty.
Go home, Beatty. You're a horse dealer. That's about one step above a thief and one step below a maniac.
At one time, I had been known as Miller Crow.
Crow? You dirty, rotten coward, come face me!
I lost that name and the wife who went with it when I murdered a crooked sheriff in Kansas City. Oh, and I resemble my cousin, Jesse Woodson James of Clay County, Missouri. Lots of folk mistook me for him. That was one more reason I tried to go unnoticed.
Save it, Crow, Beatty, Jesse James, whoever you are. I'm sure if you talk long enough, you'll make me change my mind and shoot you.
My partner was Quiet Jack Smith. We had been riding together on and off since before the war had ended. He might well have been the closest thing I ever had to a best friend in this life, which didn't mean that there weren't times I would have gladly let him get shot.
It means you can cause more trouble in the shortest time than anybody I've ever seen.
You've shot my sightseeing plumb to hell.
We'd heard talk all the way from the Missouri that Red Cloud Sioux had allied with the Cheyenne and Arapaho and were killing anything that moved between here and the Nebraska Territory and Fort Phil Kearny.
Well, Major, we're taking horses up Powder River up to Fort Kearny. I'm a dealer out of Kansas. These fellers work for me.
Do you realize what's going on up there? There's a war going on. Are you stupid or something? This town is disappearing, wagon load at a time. And all of them heading south, not north, not west, south. Doesn't that register? Any fool can get into Powder River. The difficulty will be getting out again.
Up here it was Sioux and Cheyenne. Enough of them to have the army tiptoeing around Montana, and enough to impede the laying of track for the largest railroad in the world. At least, that's the way it read in the newspapers. Red Cloud's warriors had grown steadily in numbers, and he'd served notice. This was his hunting ground, and all whites would leave or die.
You have seen what happened to others. Still you come. Why?
Business.
Your business is to come into my country? To bring horses to my enemies?
I can't deny that's why we came here. I reckon we hadn't looked at it that way.
None of your people look at it that way. I don't understand.
There were no good reasons for our going out there or doing what we did. But I've always felt that if a man needs good reasons for everything he does, he'll die in a rocking chair with nothing to remember but yesterday's weather.
Jesus, Jack. It's Long Jake and his posse.
Good. I was afraid we'd run out of something to do.
What are y'all looking at? The hell's that?
Get down, you idiot!
Scopes. That shot'll knock your head off. I admire a fellow who goes with the latest in shooting gear.
That's dangerous.
I didn't go to Powder River as I once thought to bleed it, rob it, or to watch it die. I went to feel it, breathe it, and let it cleanse me. Maybe that's why we were all there, but just couldn't realize it. And that's a shame.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net. where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220, or go to www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series or want the complete series now, check out our long-haul MP3 series sets, conveniently shipped to you on a USB flash drive. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.